were you able to sneak into anything that DC didn't know about?
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of things. Well, eventually, the problem is these things show up on national television, so eventually they find out. But
yeah, but by then it's done.
Let's put it this way. There were a couple of Easter eggs that fell into the easier to get forgiveness than beg for permission category.
Hey guys, welcome back to Screen Crush, Crossover Universe. I'm with my favorite person in the world, Ryan Airy.
And I am here with my co-host and favorite person ever in the world, Heather Antos. Hi, Heather. It's good to see you today.
Good to see you. I thought you were going to say Doug the manager.
Doug, you know, when you work for somebody, it makes the relationship awkward.
It's
That's
true.
What I'll say.
That is
it's,
true.
I can't believe this month. I don't know why in July the studios do this to us. Not only do you have Comic-Con, I can't go to Comic-Con. There's too much going on. I'm not sure when we're posting this in relation to things, but, and I know you haven't seen it yet, but I just saw Superman.
You did.
Uh-huh. And spoilers, spoiler free.
Oh, man.
And that's what you get from me on that.
I get to see it tomorrow. So I'm very pumped. I'm very excited.
I did have to go into it knowing everything, though, because we started the ending explained a few days before, and a friend of mine had already seen a screening, and I was like, hey, buddy. So he gave me and our writer and editor the skinny on it. So I knew everything. But the thing, I realized this about spoilers, though. Even if you know everything, every detail, it cannot replace the experience of actually getting to see the movie. You know, seeing how cool the visual effects are, the nuances of like Corinne Sweat's performance and Rachel Brosnahan, their chemistry. There's things about the movie that it doesn't matter if you know. Because if you read comics, you kind of know.
Yeah.
Like what it's based
on. No,
you know?
And I think one of my favorite things too, because getting to see how the sausage gets made for a lot of different franchises and a lot of different, you know, movies, TV shows. One of my favorite things when I get to go see a screening of something is to see how everyone else gets to watch it for the first time.
Yeah.
I'll never forget getting to go to the premiere of Force Awakens and then going to screenings, you know, on opening night. And
oh, I bet that was fun.
And getting to watch everyone else see that movie for the first time. One of the most joyous experiences I've ever had.
How was the audience? Like, I guess when Han Solo probably, he has the best hero entrance in that movie.
Yeah.
I imagine he got the biggest yell.
Oh, he got the biggest yell. But my favorite will always be at the very end. Spoilers if you haven't seen The Force Awakens. I don't know. That movie's been out 10 years. But when they see Luke, right? They climb up the hill
and they
see Luke. And he takes off his hood and he turns around. And this little kid who's sitting right
Holy
in front of us
cry.
Goes... He has a beard now. And I will never forget it. It was one of my favorite moments.
Oh, man. Just getting that childlike wonder out of somebody. Because we, especially when you do it professionally, we have this filter, you know? I had a weird thing with that movie where my brother-in-law is a video game designer. Mm-hmm. He worked on The Last of Us 2. He's doing the Naughty Dog's next game. And he was working on this game for a long time. Mark Hamill did mocap him.
Oh,
he was a character.
That's so
he directed fun. Mark Hamill and Gary Oldman and all the stuff for this game.
Crazy.
So they had dinner and they showed them some Lucasfilm stuff. Not Mark Hamill. I think like Lucasfilm did it. And they showed them before the trailer was even out footage of Force Awakens.
Uh-huh.
And I asked my brother-in-law, how's Luke? Is Luke okay?
Yeah.
I have to know that Luke. I was so worried about Luke Skywalker. Is he all right? And then he's like, yeah, Luke was in it. And I was like, oh, good. And I saw the movie and I was like,
where is he?
He's in 2 seconds at the end. So I had a kind of, I went in with a different set of expectations for the movie than that incredibly wonderful child you saw that was in front of you.
The great ties of, what is it? Force Awakens and the most recent Captain America movie, only Red Hulk, only in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, but spoiled in the trailer.
But spoiled in the
that's
trailer.
That's the problem, too. When you're a comic person, you know.
Yeah.
Why are you going to put Thunderbolt Ross in the movie if he's not going to be Red Hulk? Or, for instance, right, you're talking about seeing a movie to screening and then seeing it with the audience. When I saw Infinity War to screening, I was like, okay, yeah, they did the snap. Makes sense. So I could not wait to see it in theaters,
man. Oh, yeah.
And to hear, like, literally the air go out of the room with people. That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite movie experiences, just a mess of people.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Another one of my favorite movie experiences, well, just anytime I saw a Marvel screening with Chris Claremont, because that is a man who loves to talk during a movie.
It doesn't surprise me because he loves to talk in between movies too.
He does. and I can't remember which movie it was, but there was one where he was seated right behind me and just the whole film, either him cackling or, well, that's not how I did it.
I should say too, I love Chris Claremont.
Oh,
right?
He's great.
You know, obviously he's a genius, et cetera, but I've met him in person. We've interviewed him a couple times. He just is. He's a verbose
talker.
Guy.
Yeah.
He writes verbose. Like, you know, I remember him telling the story about when he did the Wolverine book with Frank Miller. And he said that Frank deliberately drew, as a lot of artists do, left him a lot of space on the page to put his bubbles in. But he got Frank Miller's art when Wolverine's fighting the head of the Yakuza at the end. And basically, Wolverine wins the fight, but he loses because he proved that Wolverine was an animal. And Claremont was like, I couldn't put words on that.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful. So we ended up with this entire page, two or three pages. Like, it was like the Snake Eyes silent issue, you know, like where he just let the action play out.
Yeah.
So he does have restraint.
He does have restraint. He does. He does.
Talking during a movie, that's the, to quote Firefly, that's the special circle of hell reserved for people who talk at the theater.
Oh, man. Well, speaking of someone who's put many things in theater, should we introduce our guest?
You know what, Heather? You know so many people, and I cannot believe we're about to talk to this guy. I'm starstruck. I really am. I'm in awe of this. So, yes, by all means.
All right. Well, today we are talking to the one, the only Mark Guggenheim. Mark Guggenheim is an award-winning writer who has written for multiple mediums, including television, film, video games, comic books, and more. His work includes projects such as one of the Percy Jackson films. He's worked on Star Wars, Call of Duty, Star Trek, Planet of the Apes, and most importantly, co-writer of the Green Lantern movie and co-creator of the Arrowverse. Mark Guggenheim, how the heck are you?
Mark Guggenheim.
I'm great. How could I not be great with such a wonderful introduction? You guys have made me feel so good about myself.
Well,
we had to shorten
the cancel therapy this week.
we could have made that introduction 8 times longer. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's really great to see you both.
Mark, I have to, before we get into like everything, I just have to like personally, I know I've told you this in person, but I have to personally thank you for inadvertently being the reason I work in comic books. You know, I've told you this before. The Green Lantern movie is the film, you know, I know it has some polarizing views, but that is the movie that made me start reading superhero comic books. They announced that film. I really didn't know anything about Green Lantern. And for whatever reason, I decided, you know, despite all the Marvel films that had been out, despite all the Batman films that had come out, the Green Lantern film was the one that made me go to the comic shop, pick up, you know, Emerald Dawn, pick up Secret Origins. And I just became a hardcore Green Lantern film fan leading up to that film. And Green Lantern comics are still to this day. I have more Green Lantern comics than any other comics. So your fault.
Well, thank you. By the way, I've heard that phrase, it's all your fault, a lot in connection with Green Lantern over the years. So that tracks. It tracks.
You've also stolen several hours of my life with the Arrowverse, which I thank you for so much.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I've got them actually. Right, I have them in my attic if you want them back.
I wasn't going to do anything with them anyways. That was just Tetris and phone time. All yours.
So before we get into the nitty gritty of, you know, all the odds and bits and bobbles of your career, I have to ask the burning question that has to be on everyone's mind, which is how the heck does a lawyer become a TV and film writer?
You know, well, I'll tell you, first of all, like I used to be a litigator.
Yeah.
So I kind of like to say that actually the only job you can get as a litigator that's not litigation is as a TV or film writer. No one wants to hire you to do anything else. Trust me. I tried. But the way it happened, the super short version is that I'm the oldest of three brothers. All of us are screenwriters. My brother, Eric, the middle brother, he was in film school when I was in my last year of law school. And he basically asked if I would write a script with him. And I really got bit by the bug. And I just was like, went into practice. I was practicing for like 5 years. And on the side, I was, honing my craft and practicing and trying different scripts and stuff. And I basically got to this point where I was like, you know what, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to try to be a professional writer, I've got to do it now before I have a wife, three kids, and a mortgage. And I quit my job and I scheduled my move out west to coincide with staffing season. There was a period of time, believe it or not, back when, way before streaming, where, for like 2 months out of the year, that's when shows would staff up.
Yeah, staffing, and pilot season, all of the good old days.
Yeah, it's all the good old days where there was like, where there was clarity and where there was like a procedure. It was very nice. It was lovely. And I got very lucky. I ended up getting hired on a show called The Practice, which was created by David Kelly, who did Big Little Lies and Ally McBeal and Presumed Innocent. And he was looking to hire first-year writers who used to be lawyers. And I also happened to have spent the previous 5 years practicing in the jurisdiction where the show took place. So the answer, the really short answer to your question, how does a lawyer become a writer, is in an incredible amount of luck, an incredible amount of right place, right time.
I love that you started all of this by saying in my free time as a lawyer, as a litigator, because I imagine there's just loads of that.
it's funny. So I really struggled with finding time to write because I found like I was exhausted by the end of the day and my brain just wouldn't work. And I would say I wrote over the weekends, but that would mean having weekends off, which was not the case as a lawyer. But then I actually read an interview with a writer named Ron Bass, who actually wrote all the movies in the 90s.
Yeah.
And he used to be a former lawyer, and he was saying that before he broke in, he would wake up at 5 in the morning every morning and write. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I wrote from 5 to 7 each day, at least 2 hours. And it was brutal waking up that early and stuff, but it was the only time I could really write.
Can I ask, when you were doing that, honing your craft and everything, I assumed you were writing spec scripts for shows.
I was.
What shows were you, when was this, and what shows were you writing spec scripts for? And were any of them Simon & Simon?
None of them were Simon & Simon. The funny thing is, believe it or not, it started out, my brother and I, we wrote 2 episodes of a show called Picket Fences, also created by David Kelly.
Yeah.
And we did a Law & Order. Then we did a original feature. And then Eric and I we thought we were very clever. We wrote a pilot about the senior staff of the White House. And
they've never done a show that before,
right?
No.
Well, the day we finished the script, they announced The West Wing.
Oh my God.
And we're like, okay, well, that was a big waste of time. And then Eric, graduated and had to go off and find a job, as people who graduate college do. So we started writing separately, and I didn't actually write too many specs. I was writing a lot of, original features, because my manager, Yeah, because my manager, believe it or not, was like, she would ask me a lot about my dating life and such as it was. And she would ask me a lot about my dating life, and I would sort of tell her stories about various bad dates I went on. And she's like, you really should write a romantic comedy. I'm like, I don't know if I can do that. She's like, no, you would. The way you tell stories about your love life, again, such as it is, you would do a really good romantic comedy. And I, sure enough, I wrote this romantic comedy that actually sort of put me on the map. It gave me the confidence that there were people out in Los Angeles who were interested in my writing. So I wrote that. I wrote another spec romantic comedy. I wrote a spec Star Trek Voyager though.
Ooh.
That was a lot of fun. The spec that broke me into the business was a spec West Wing during the first season of that show. Then I did, because I needed a writing sample coming out of the practice, I did essentially a spec practice because I didn't really have anything, any material that I thought worked well together. So, you know, but mostly it was a lot of original features.
So I am very curious, though, because, you know, you have written on a lot of law-focused television in the past. You know, The Practice, Dragnet, Law, of course, Law and Order, CSI, and Justice. I could go on. Everyone loves to talk about how accurate law television is. as someone who
is it accurate?
No, I mean Suits, right? Suits has got to be the most accurate show of all time. No, but I'd be curious as someone who actually was a litigator, who spent time in courtroom, studied the law. Was it ever frustrating being in writers' rooms to have to like say that's not how it works, or did folks actually try to stay pretty close to the book?
You know, it's a good question. First of all, it was never frustrating because I think everyone sort of in the room, including the lawyers among us, recognize that it's not a documentary. It is fiction. And the truth is, anyone who's actually been in a courtroom or been in a trial or in a deposition knows that no one's going to make a TV show out of this. It is not the way it is portrayed in real life.
I've had jury duty, I know.
I think any attorney turned writer worth their salt knows that a huge amount of artistic license has to be taken. I always said, like, my artistic license is new and laminated.
Yeah.
Like, I would always make use of it.
The Wire always struck me as probably the most realistic show on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I love The Wire.
The Wire. Another one I've heard is Better Call Saul. A lot of people say Better Call Saul is like is pretty accurate.
It is.
There might not be a single trial in Better Call Saul. I think everything is plea bargains.
There's a lot of motion practice in Better Call Saul, although they did have the trial where Jimmy, you know, tried to get his law license back and cross-examined his brother and everything. I will say this, like, I think you sort of very quickly get a sense when you're writing these law shows as to what you can take license with and what you can't.
Yeah.
Like, there is trials are conducted in a very specific way, particularly criminal trials, which make up the bulk of television. And it's like, no, the prosecution has to present their case first. There has to be cross-examination. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of times, like I would say Law and Order actually really got a lot of the law right. Like when we cited cases on the show, those were real cases. You know, they were talking about real precedent. You know, it's just sexied up and it's sped up. It's really the speeding up of the process more than anything that I think is the biggest.
I was going to say every case and, you know, gets solved within what, 2 weeks in a TV show?
Oh, it's crazy. Well, it's also like, by the way, like when DNA results come back, they come back in hours. It's like, no, that takes weeks.
Yeah.
We find
fingerprints in 2 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah. Come on.
And they find DNA like they're measuring for carpet.
Oh,
in the living
room. Oh, my gosh.
It's like it's that fast.
There's a lot of, but I don't know. I do know people who like get frustrated about this stuff, but they're the kind of people who like, I think, don't like to be entertained. I just think fundamentally there are people who watch television and movies who really do not want to be entertained, and they are just going to find some reason to be upset. I don't write for those people. I don't like to work with those people. It's just no fun.
Oh, my God. Well, so it's the early 2000s. We've done all the law TV. Dark Knight has taken the world by storm. Man of Steel is out there. You know, MCU is just kicking it off with Iron Man. And you just so happened to write the screenplay for Green Lantern. How did you make the jump from doing all of this television to breaking into the DCU?
Well, I did not do it alone. Basically, I was doing a pilot with Greg Berlanti,
right,
who I've worked on a bunch of things with. And we were kind of like treated like the ugly stepchild show of ABC. Greg and I were flying back from a casting session in New York, and, you know, we're both kind of like feeling like, you know, this is such a slog, and, you know, it's frustrating that we're doing this work that's not getting respect. And Greg's like, you know what, kind of screw ABC, you know, we're still going to do the show if they pick it up, but, you know, I've got this idea for how to do a Green Lantern show. And he basically, like, over the cross-country flight pitched me, you know, the whole vision for Green Lantern, which really was, you know, Lord of the Rings meets Star Wars meets a cop show.
I love it.
You know, and I was like, I am totally, and you don't have to, like, you know, twist my arm. And we brought on Michael Green, who Greg and I had both worked with on Jack and Bobby. Mm-hmm. Michael is like the most talented writer I'm personally friends with. Like, he went on to do Logan and Blade Runner 2049 and you name it. So the three of us basically, like, you know, wrote this, and we spent, it was a long process. We really, like, spent a long time trying to get that script right. And then a very lucky thing happened. We turned in the first draft of the script to Warner Brothers the weekend Iron Man premiere.
Oh my God.
Oh,
and
wow.
Was that on
it
purpose?
It was like, and no, it was totally accidental, completely accidental.
You're supposed to say, yes, we planned this out.
I know, we should have. I know. There's a lot in the whole Green Lantern process I wish we were smarter about. And, you know, and basically, like, and Greg was attached to direct. And, you know, we turned in this draft, and lo and behold, on Monday, Warner Brothers, who I don't think really took it very seriously, like, it's three TV writers, you know, but we're like, oh, this script's really good. Like, we're gonna, you know, we didn't immediately say we're gonna make this, but they did start saying we're gonna start spending money on this. And, you know, we sort of have like a flashing green light, and Greg, you know, sort of convened a whole sort of team of artists to do concept art and previs, and we were moving along. And then what happened next was actually very predictable, which is Warner Brothers did wake up one morning and was like, wait a second. We're going to spend $250 million on a screenplay written by three TV writers and directed by the director of the Broken Hearts Club. Like, no, we're not doing that. Like, you know, get real. And I'm like, okay, I can't really blame them. You know, so they brought in Martin Campbell, mm-hmm. fresh off of Casino Royale, which, again, fresh off of Casino Royale, it seemed like a good idea at the time, to direct. And they brought on Michael Goldenberg off of Harry Potter to sort of, you know, be the closer, mm-hmm. the closer on the script. The thing that I like to say is that a very simple Google search will surface our original draft, and the movie became what the movie became, you know?
We've got a video up on the channel right now, you know, defending the movie. Like, we oh, recognize it wow. wasn't perfect, but there is a lot about the movie to love.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was going to say, like, Mark Strong as Sinestro is, like, one of the best supervillain performances.
That was great casting.
Perfect casting.
Can I tell you a story?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, it's my first big Hollywood movie. I've seen it by this point, so I know it's about to be my last. And I'm like, I'm going to spring for a limo to, you know, to go to the premiere. Like, it's a man's Chinese theater. It's Hollywood Boulevard, you know. So my wife and I, we go in the limo, and I get out on Hollywood Boulevard, and I get out, and people start chanting, Mark, Mark. And I'm like, holy shit, this is the best thing ever. This is amazing. And I turn, and behind me, there's another limo. And Mark Strong had just gotten out.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, that does make a little bit more sense.
If only they said Mark with a K.
Right. But it was like for 2 seconds there, I was like, I really felt
they,
very
they were
very
cheating
important.
For you. Who's that guy? They were. It was absolutely.
Yeah,
who's
Mark Strong?
Absolutely.
The world's no, there, tuxedo there were things and you were a right. pair of brown shoes.
There were things there. It's fine. I haven't gone back and looked at the movie again. I people do tell me it, like, it's aged pretty well. And I do look at, like, other superhero movies that have come out since. And I go, you know, like, you're giving me crap for Green Lantern? Look at that movie.
Yeah.
You know,
I think all the ingredients were there. Maybe they just weren't cooked at the right temperature.
You know, I'll tell you, when I read Michael Goldenberg's draft, I called up Greg, and my take on the draft was that Martin basically was doubling down on himself because all the work that we had done in terms of heart and humor and a certain groundedness were gone from the draft, but could be restored in the performances and in the execution. So it really became like, okay, it's all up to Martin now.
You know, that makes me wonder too, because there's, especially at that time, right? This was the first really cosmic superhero film. And there's always been this tug of war in superhero films and television shows between grounded realism and comic book apparatus, right? And you know, how, as someone who works both in comic books and on, you know, on the screen, how do you approach like balancing that tonal act?
I would say getting the tone right, at least on the page, was probably the thing that made that made writing the script as difficult as it was. And it's the thing we took the most time with, because it was both a tonal issue, but it was also sort of like a narrative structure issue of like, at what point do you go to Oa? Like, is the climax on Earth or is the climax in space?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had two villains. So like we had Hector Hammond, right. We had,
yeah.
You know, we had what became Parallax. And we were like, who does Hal defeat first?
Right.
You know, there were a lot of questions like that. And we did a variety of different drafts past the first draft. It wasn't like we were immediately kicked off the movie. We tried a bunch of different things. You know, my favorite bit from our original draft was, it was two things. It was basically during the sequence where Abin Sur's ring is traveling the world looking for someone courageous, someone brave. It goes, you know, to the offices of a major metropolitan newspaper, and it flies around this guy with glasses and then keeps moving on. But then like Michael Green wrote this great stage direction where, you know, you're hearing Abin's voice going, find me someone courageous, someone brave. And the stage direction said it approaches Washington, D.C. and continues on without stopping.
Oh,
I don't know if that bit would have translated into film, but I always
liked
it.
That's great. That's,
it sounds like I see it as a comic panel.
No, I absolutely you know, going over all of North America, honing in, and just.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. There was definitely some fun to be had. Let's put it that way.
That's so fun. Well, then how does that then translate, right, to the Arrowverse? Because you partnered with Greg Berlanti on that as well. And, you know, I can't imagine when you guys first put together that pitch for that show that you had any inkling it was going to turn into the massive television multiverse that it did.
Not only did we not have an inkling, we didn't want to do the show. Like, you know, we did. Like, so what happened was, you know, Greg and I were both at ABC Studios. You know, I forget who left first. I left and Greg left. I forget in which order. But Greg returned to Warner Brothers, where he had had his first deal. And Peter Roth, the head of Warner Brothers Television, very, very enthusiastic, very passionate guy, had heard Greg over lunch tell him about his idea for a Green Arrow TV show. And Greg and I had been talking about it. Greg asked me if I wanted to do it with him, and I said yes. But then we started to go through the Green Lantern process. Basically, like the summer, like 2 weeks after Green Lantern comes out and bombs and, you know, sort of gets eviscerated by the critics, Peep's calling going, where's my Green Arrow show? And Greg and I are looking at each other going like, do we really want to do this again? I mean, it's got green in the title too. Like, I mean, we're dumb, but we're not stupid. And we kind of said no. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Peter is very passionate, like I said, and he's very, you know, he's a dog, like a dog with a bone. And he kept calling. He even called me. I'm like, what are you even calling me? Like, you know, I'm nobody. Like, and Greg, he basically got Greg and I to a point where Greg and I sat in his office on the Warner Brothers lot going, okay, if we were to do this, what would it have to look like? Like, what would it have to look like for our sanity, but also so that we don't run into the same creative problems that we ran into with Green Lantern? And basically what we did was we sort of made them, and not an offer that they couldn't refuse, but an offer that they should have refused, where we said, we're not doing this in the traditional way. We're not doing a story error. We're not doing outline. We're not, like, you're not even going to do an article in Deadline Hollywood. Like, this is going to be really simple. We're going to do two meetings. We're going to pitch to you, the studio, and then we're going to go across the street. We're going to pitch to the CW. And if you like it, we will write you a script. And if you off that script, no notes, no nothing, you will decide whether or not you're making the pilot.
Wow.
That does not happen.
No,
it really does not. Back when I was a lawyer, you know, 99% of cases settle, and I was always negotiating settlements. And I always said to my clients, if you're willing to walk away from the table, I can get you a better settlement. There's no leverage like the ability to say no. And because Greg and I were so not interested in just having another bad experience, certainly having another bad experience with a DC comic book character, you know, it really drove a lot of our thinking. So as a result, we ended up doing something that was very, very, very true to our vision. And I think, honestly, the show was better because of it.
I have two hot questions real quick. Is your favorite color green?
My favorite color is not green. It's not. Yeah.
And if you had to pick between Green Lantern or Green Arrow, who's your favorite superhero?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really good question.
Has no one ever asked you that?
No one's ever asked me that.
That's crazy.
That's a Screen Crush crossover universe exclusive coming up right now, baby. Let's go.
I'd probably Green Arrow just because I've spent so much friggin' time with him.
And help define the character. I mean, for a lot of people, their perception of Green Arrow is your Green Arrow.
It's weird. It's very weird. We'd actually, like, for the last season, we had done like a Photoshop test of Steven with a goatee. And I thought it looked terrific, actually. I still have it, like... I just
want to give him the little Robin Hood cap. Like that's
the Robin Hood cap would never happen.
We were
all about Longbow Hunters and the hood.
Oh, I love that. I have an autographed copy of that by Mike Grill.
The very first time Greg mentioned Green Arrow TV show to me, the whole concept of the island and flashbacks was you know Greg's idea from the beginning. I'm like, very first two comics, you know, we have to reread are Longbow Hunters and Green Arrow Year One.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean,
can I ask real quick,
Go ahead.
Did your experience on Green Lantern have anything to do with dropping Green from the title of Arrow, or was that just to keep him grounded and realistic?
No, it was definitely related. It was absolutely related. I mean, we were like, originally, the original working title was The Hunter.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But we were originally like, how do we, you know, how do we, yes, grounded, but also distinguish it from, you know, our Green Lantern experience? I think we had PTSD with respect to the word green.
Got it. Understandable. So you're going in, you know, to Warner Brothers, you're pitching flat out. This is our show. This is our script. Pick it up or no. Obviously, they said yes. I mean, we're where we are today. Oliver Queen's arc is so layered in that show.
It's
all about legacy, guilt, leadership, redemption, all of the above, probably more. How much of his journey was mapped out for you guys from the very beginning versus did it start evolving based on Steven's performance or like audience reception?
I would say kind of all of the above. Like, so the way Greg and I like to work is the way I like to describe it is it's kind of the way I like to go to Europe. I like to have my museum tickets and I like to have my dinner reservations and maybe a guide or two booked. But at the same time, if I hear about this amazing gallery or something, I want to go and check it out. So we always go into, you know, we went into the series and we went into each season with very specific plans for Oliver's arc and his journey of redemption. But, you know, when you're doing 23 episodes a year in particular, you really are reacting to, you know, what you're seeing on the screen and in dailies and everything.
Yeah.
For us at the beginning, you know, when we were talking about Oliver's arc, it was... you know, it was really heavily influenced, believe it or not, by Brody's storyline, Damian Lewis's storyline in Homeland. You know, we really wanted to play the idea of this guy, the survivor of something terrible that comes back with PTSD. And then we knew there were certain things that we were going to sort of do in terms of evolving him. The idea of him becoming a leader of heroes actually came... you know, it came pretty late in the process, I would say. And that really was in large part because of Steven's performance. Mm-hmm. And sort of like seeing like, oh, you can sort of see him, you know, ordering other heroes around, really.
Yeah.
And then there were other things. I always say, like, you know, I went into the show with my deck of cards. I want to do this and I want to do this and I want to do this. And I didn't necessarily know what order I wanted to do them in.
Yeah.
But I knew it was time for me to step off the show when I'm like, I was down to my last card and my last card was kill Oliver. And this was the end of season six. I'm like, oh, that's too soon.
Yeah.
Because my penultimate card was expose Oliver's secret to the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was stuff that was part like in my head and part of the show from day one.
So I have to imagine, too, there are characters like Felicity Smoke that total surprise. I was going to say, yeah. like she was just kind of a cameo in that first episode. Yeah. But I feel like, I mean,
Emily Rickards.
Her performance is so charismatic. She's so captivating. Like, immediately became a fan favorite from Go.
That character's so funny because, you know, I always joke to Greg, we create a show that we couldn't write. And by that, I mean, you know, Greg and I were very like, we are kind of romantic comedy writers. That's both of us got our start writing romantic comedies, really. And we're very like quippy, Sorkin-y, you know, very sort of like screwball romantic comedy type of writers. And we wrote the darkest, most taciturn, silent guy ever. So when we needed a character just to like do an IT thing in episode 3, it was like, oh, finally, the character we know how to write.
Yeah.
And then I remember vividly, because Emily's Canadian and she didn't come into audition in Los Angeles. She went on tape in Vancouver. And I remember watching her audition and I ran into Andrew Kreisberg's office saying, you have to watch this audition. You have to see this actress. It was a revelation. And then when the network started seeing the dailies with Emily, they were like, can we see more of her? And we're like, we're way ahead of you. We're already breaking episodes 4 and
Amazing.
5 with her in it. Like, yeah, it wasn't even a question for us.
Wow.
We realized like that was the flavor the stew needed.
Yeah.
You know, like I always say, like, you know, when I did Flash Forward, I realized too late in the run that we didn't have a Hurley character. You know, like, you need a character. If you're going to do dark stuff, you got to have one comic relief character. And originally that was supposed to be Tommy, but it never quite, you know, it never quite manifested. It never quite worked. I don't think we were writing the right stuff for Colin Donnell, who played Tommy. You know, so thank God for Emily. Like, thank God that happened.
It's funny you say that. It was such a dark show, but some of the things that stand out to me the most in Arrow, apart from the fight scenes, which are a whole other, they're amazing. There's a line that Captain Lance has in a later season. It's when Damian Dark is like taking over the city and all this stuff, and all this stuff's happening at once. And Lance goes, yeah, I mean, what is it, May already? Because it's the end of the season.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it must be May, right? Like, I loved that line.
You.
I've put that in videos as a cutaway.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. I love that. We definitely, like, you know, it's fine. I grew up with, like, I always say, like, you know, Empire Strikes Back is a huge, huge, huge influence on me, because I always say it's the darkest Star Wars, but it's also the funniest Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real object lesson for, you know, for 10-year-old me, going like, oh, it's more dramatic if there's some levity, and the levity is funnier if it's dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
Just that combination has, like, I think you can almost pretty much describe my entire voice as a writer based on, you know, what I call the Empire Strikes Back paradox.
I love that.
Well, speaking of some dark television, the Deathstroke arc in season 2 is still held up, in my opinion, as some of the best comic book television TV arcs ever.
Thank you.
How did that come together? And why do you think, like, Slade Wilson made for the perfect opponent for Oliver Queen?
Well, you know, it's funny. So originally, there was no plans for Deathstroke. And we were in prep on the pilot, and David Nutter, who directed the pilot, who's like, basically David Nutter's the Steven Spielberg of television. He's like directed 19 pilots and 18 have gone to series, many of them huge series. He directed the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones. And, you know, David's brilliant. And basically, it was sort of taking us through this shot, the opening shot of what turned out to be the opening shot of the pilot, of sort of panning across Lian Yu. And he's like, I really would love like some sort of totem, some sort of something right here in the foreground. And actually, it was Jeff Johns who said it could be the Deathstroke's mask. And we're like, it can? We can do that?
That's cool.
So it really started out with, it really started out with like, just an Easter egg.
Uh-huh.
And then it was like, well, can we have that, you know, that mask in the flashbacks? Sure. Oh, okay. Well, we've got that character. Can we actually introduce Slade Wilson in the flashbacks? And it was like, yeah. So it was like these little baby steps. But I think fundamentally the reason why Slade works so well as an antagonist for Oliver was really two things. First of all, Manu Bennett's performance, absolutely outstanding, totally embodied the character, you know, all props to him for making that work the way it did. But I also think it was the fact that this was a villain who came from Oliver's past, you know, who was on the island with him, who, you know, was motivated by this, you know, sense of jealousy and betrayal. So he was just this very visceral villain, as opposed to, you know, pretty much all the other villains we had were all villains that sort of come into the story and sort of are fighting with Oliver as Oliver's already a hero. But I think for Slade to have developed this animosity and this antagonism with Oliver as Oliver was becoming a protagonist, I feel like that was like the special sauce that you couldn't replicate.
So we're about a third the way through season two, and there's a scientist character that pops up.
Yes.
Everyone's favorite Barry Allen, right? At what point in Arrow season one, season two, did Warner Brothers come to you, or did you guys go to Warner Brothers and be like, hey, what if we did another show?
That I think it was like towards the end of season one, Greg said to Mark Pedowitz, the president of CW, I'd really like to do The Flash next. And, you know, Mark was all in on it. I was actually not involved with The Flash. Believe it or not, Michael Green and I, working with Greg, had done a feature film version of The Flash.
Wow.
It didn't go forward, I think in large part because Green Lantern turned out to be what it turned out to be. We did a whole sort of take on The Flash, which is not dissimilar to what they ended up doing on the show, but I wasn't involved. I was working on Arrow season two.
Well, from there, right, Flash season one happens during Arrow season three, and then eventually they do the first ever on television comic book crossover event.
Yes.
How did that happen?
So, well, basically, okay, so this I can take some responsibility for, just because because I got very involved in the crossovers because I love the idea of them so much. And believe it or not, the reason I love them so much, this was something that Greg and I, it really came about because Greg was like, I want to do it.
Yeah.
But the reason Greg wanted to do it was he and I both love the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman.
Yeah.
And Greg and I we sort of joke, really share a childhood. And the highlights of those shows were the crossovers.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, we've got an opportunity to, do mm-hmm. $6 Million mm-hmm. Man, the Bionic Woman, crossovers in television. So I was just so into it. Like I was so, it scratched all my itches. It also scratched my itch as a producer, because producing those crossovers was such an interesting challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It presented like a scheduling challenge, logistical challenge, especially in the early days when we'd never done it before.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the puzzle of it.
I was going to say, did the shows shoot their seasons at the same time, or did you have
yes
to, yeah
oh, and so on, the same, on the same lot as well?
Yeah.
Yes, actually, well, Flash and Arrow shot on the same lot. The subsequent shows shot on different lots in Vancouver.
Wow, that must have been incredibly hard.
Yeah, especially Crisis.
Well, Crisis.
The thing is, we kept each year we increased the degree of difficulty.
Yeah.
You really did.
Each year we learned something new. Like we learned, for example, like, oh, you know, we need some down days built in to the various shows so that there can be proper crossing over of people. You know, when we first did it, we were trying to make, you know, the Flash episode of the crossover and the Arrow episode of the crossover work at the same time. And it was like the scheduling was just insane. In fact, like,
I can only imagine.
I think it's the end of the first act of the Flash, the Arrow Hour. We were having really trouble. We were shooting at Star Labs, which was going to be a location. And the act out is, you know, the Flash speeds in and catches these boomerangs that Captain Boomerang throws. And it was the one, it was like the outlier. It was like the one friggin' scene we could not like schedule Grant for, and we need a Grant because the whole point is it's Grant. And it was really tough because it was on location. We were like, okay, do we like build a set, you know, on the sound stages somewhere? And that way we don't have to travel Grant and everything. And then just, I was in the middle of a meeting and we were banging our heads against the wall about it. I'm like, wait a second. Like, if you look at the script, it's basically two shots. It's, you know, it's the Flash speeding in, which we know is going to be a digi double anyway. Yeah. And then it's Grant, you know, the reveal of Grant. I'm like, why can't we just get a plate at the location and do the reveal of Grant against the green screen? Mm-hmm. And it looks like Grant is on the location.
Yeah.
And it's like, coming up with solutions like that is the whole, for me, like that was the fun part of the crossovers. Like, okay, how do we do this? How do we make this happen?
Especially when you're the one writing it. It makes it easier to produce it as well.
Well, it does. But you know what's funny? I think the reason the shows looked the way they did and were the way they were was we always wrote without an eye towards production. Mm-hmm. You know, the way I sort of show run is I always say the first draft will always come out on the first day of prep and it will be unproducible. But the shooting script 8 days later will absolutely be producible. Yeah. And it's sort of like the way I sort of describe it is it's you have to do it like a car, like in a car compactor. Like, you know, it's going to get smaller in the compactor, but it's still going to weigh as much as the car. But you have to start out with a car in order to accomplish that. So there were a lot of times where you're just sort of cursing past you. Like, man, why did I write that? Why did I do that? That's so stupid.
Change the more you write.
It really doesn't. It really doesn't. I think all you can ever sort of hope for is... You know, I think with experience comes a certain amount of calm. Like, okay, it's not working now. It's not going to be working next week. At some point, it will start working.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't panic about story the way I used to or panic about production the way I used to because I know it by hook or by crook, it gets figured out.
Arrow was to 2020, like all the Arrowverse everything, right?
2020, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, between that, Flash, the crossover, Legends of Tomorrow, Crisis, and you know, both Crises.
The multiverse shows, Black Lightning, Batwoman, yeah.
Was there a character that you didn't get to touch that you really wanted to?
And by the way, this wasn't DC's fault. This one was totally mine. I always thought the Question would be absolutely perfect for Arrow.
Oh, like, that would have been cool.
Like such a no-brainer. And
yeah, that was great.
It's funny. It's like even when you're doing 8 seasons, we never found its time and never found its moment.
Well, and then she popped up in Gotham.
Yes, that's true. And that did sort of diminish our chances of using.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and because it was always a negotiation and stuff. But I will say, like, DC was always really, really great. They let us use far more characters than we ever expected.
Yeah.
In a million years, you know. People often ask me, like, which characters do you regret not being able to use? I'm like, I don't have any real regrets in the sense that, like, I, you know, our glass is more than half full.
Yeah.
You know, our cup runs
over. You basically played with the entire, like, street level roster.
Pretty much did.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what really, when I watched all those shows through, as an old school, like, Silver Age, Bronze Age DC Comics reader, I never thought I would see Rip Hunter or Vandal Savage Stargirl.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, did you have a background in comics? Like, did you grow up reading them or did you just follow?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
This guy's a comics nerd. Yeah.
Yeah. I like one of my earliest memories is like flipping through a Superman comic book on the floor of my bedroom at home. And, you know, my mother comes in and I couldn't read at that point, but she thought she raised a savant. And I'm like, no, I'm just looking at the pictures. I don't even know where I got the comic book from. Mm-hmm. I'm such a comic book guy.
So if you ever get a time machine in your life, make sure that you travel back in time and give your young self that comic, because it may have been you
That would really make so much sense. I work for 10-year-old
me. Legends of Tomorrow was my favorite show.
Thank you. Well, Legends was a lot of fun, and it was a great antidote. Like, when I was co-running both shows at the same time, it was like, I'd spend like a week rewriting like Arrow, and it's dark and dreary, and you know everything takes place at night. And then Legends was this nice little amuse-bouche, you know, that sort of restores my faith in humanity a little bit.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fun to work on.
A lot of fun.
If between, okay, so between both universes, you have Arrow and you have Legends. Which character are you the sidekick for?
Ooh, good question. Character am I the sidekick for?
We won't give you the responsibility of being a hero because no one wants that. But,
yeah.
You can be the man in the chair for anyone you want.
Yeah. I kind of feel like I want to be the man in the chair for Diggle.
Okay.
That's good. You know, I like that. Free ring or coast ring?
Free. Well, the ring was, you know, always a negotiation and some cajoling, yeah, and some arm twisting and some getting in trouble. You know, we actually like had for season 8, we gave Diggle's costume a redesign. You know, we gave it a green color, but it also, in the original designs, it had like basically the lantern glyph.
Mm.
And DC was like, no, you can't do that. Aww. So it was always like, you know, again, a little dance.
Were you able to sneak into anything that DC didn't know about?
Oh, yeah. There's a couple things. Well, eventually, the problem is these things show up on national television, so eventually they find out. But
yeah, but by then it's done.
Let's put it this way. There were a couple of Easter eggs that fell into the easier to get forgiveness than beg for permission category. The, you know, fighter pilots, bomber jacket guy in Coast City, and the season 4 flashbacks that has the name Jordan on it.
Yep.
That was one of them. A big one was when the Legends of Tomorrow brought Helen of Troy to a island full of Amazonian type women.
What is that a reference to?
well, we clarified it by actually Chironing on the screen Themyscira.
Amazing.
Oh, okay.
I was actually I was the one who made the final call to do that. Sorry, DC. You now know it was me. But I was like I was reviewing visual effect shots.
Yeah.
And the shot of Themyscira was a visual effect shot, and someone said like, it's a shame we can't just, you know, Chiron Themyscira here. And I'm like,
why not?
Well, I knew why not, but I'm like, let's do it anyway.
Ask for forgiveness, not permission, you know?
Exactly. You know, then there was like in Elseworlds when John Wesley Shipp's Flash sees Diggle. Actually, David Ramsey came to me and said, can we do something? You know, we've got this opportunity with this, you know, this other Flash. Can we do something about Diggle in the ring? And I'm like, okay, let me see. Let me see. I don't know. Like, I came up with, John, why aren't you wearing your ring? And that got, I got a phone call. I got a little slap on the wrist phone call for that one. All worth it.
Oh, man.
Hey, Heather, I want to ask one of James's questions.
Absolutely.
If that's okay.
Yeah. Jump in.
I got it. So, Mark, one of our editor for the podcast, James Somerville. Hi, James. How are you? You can find James's social links below. Sent a litany of questions. There's one I want to make sure I get to, though. In the Crisis on Earth X crossover, the Green Arrow of Earth 1 had a kryptonite arrow, and he told Supergirl from Earth 38 he had it in case an evil you ever showed up. Where did he get the kryptonite arrow?
Great question. You know, we did have an answer for it. Like, we knew that people were going to ask that question. And even though we didn't like plan on explicating it in the episodes, we did have an answer, and it was so long ago. I'm trying to remember what it was. It might have been, I don't remember. Gosh,
if
it comes to me.
But I just want to say impressed I am that you did think it through that far, even though it wasn't going to be in the episode, because I mean, I've talked to a lot of Star Trek people, Heather, I know you have too. And when they come up with this thing or the gobbledygook, like 26 episodes, you just got
to
get
know.
It out. They're not thinking
about
it.
Yeah, they need to know.
They're not always thinking about what fits into memory alpha.
Yeah.
So, thank you. Well, thank you for
the unit
that.
Is, I think, you know, we sort of realized that our fans were very involved and very observant and very active on the internet. And we were like, we should always have an answer for something.
Yeah.
You know, even if it doesn't make the screen, because, it's fine. Like, I'm working on an animated show right now, and there's a couple of things. They're more like logic things, like where I'm like, there's never going to be an opportunity to actually dramatize this or get this dialogue out without seeming nakedly expositional. But as long as we have an answer for it, I feel like, you know, we've done our job.
Very cool. Well, Before we get to Hear Me Out, I do want to jump into the actual world of comic books. You know, you don't just adapt them for the TV. You also write the books themselves. You know, everything from you've done work on Spider-Man, X-Men, Wolverine, Star Wars, Blade, you know, Planet of the Apes. There's a saying in the world of comic writers that I think you can speak to both as someone who writes for comics and TV, that comics is so freeing because there is no budget. There's no producer saying, no, we can't do that because we can't have 1,000 extras or we can't go to space or we ran out of the CG budget. And your experience has working in comics, has it had an elevated sense of creative freedom that you don't get in TV?
I mean, certainly, yes. Like, it's less freedom and more like, I don't have to worry about it. Like, I don't have to worry about how I'm going to produce this. You know, so that's kind of nice. I have other sort of things that, like, I worry about. Like, I worry a lot. I don't worry about budget, obviously, with a comic book, but I do worry about the fact that I have to ask another human to draw this stuff. And I'm always sort of very cognizant that, you know, I don't want to be that jerk who goes, you know, 1,000 people storm the castle in panel one. Yeah. Like, you know, like, you know, it's funny. Like, I just finished a book, an issue of Spider-Man and Wolverine, and like Spider-Man's down like in a subway tunnel and there's a whole bunch of these characters that are coming at him. And I'm like, look, it's a double page spread. Draw as many as you can. I will say, you know, without driving yourself crazy, but I will say, like, the coolness of this issue is directly proportional to how many we can of these characters we can see in this spread. So, you know, I just try to like be very honest with the, you know, with the artist and be like, I'm respectful of your time. I'm respectful of your energy. You know, if you can't make this work, we'll figure out another way. Yeah. But you know, but that's, there's just, you're trading one set of limitations for another.
But also no pressure, right? No pressure for that artist.
I always try not to be, like I said, a jerk. And when the story does call for it or requires me to be one, I always apologize.
So you got to be a part of one of the biggest, most recent Spider-Man series, Brand New Day.
Yeah.
Very defining, you know, arc for Peter. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, how that came to happen? I mean, that's partnering with Dan Slott, who's the most prolific Spider-Man writer of all time. You know, Steve McNiven was drawing on that, who's just an insanely credible and kind artist. You know, Salvador La Roca. Totally. Like, I mean, what was that like, getting to write probably, you know, next to Batman and Superman, the most famous superhero?
It was a total dream. I had signed an exclusive with Marvel, and as part of the exclusive, they invited me to be, you know, part of what we were calling ourselves, the Webheads or the Spidey Brain Trust or something. And the idea was, instead of publishing Amazing Spider-Man and Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, and at the time Web of Spider-Man and Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, they were just going to publish Amazing. And they were going to publish it three times a month.
Three times a week. Oh, my God.
Wow. Can you imagine? Like, that's like every editor going,
I did a weekly comic 3 times a week. Like, Jesus.
That would be, yeah, it's not possible. So 3 times a month. And the idea was like that they would assemble a team of writers to sort of operate kind of like a TV writing staff. I'm like, this is amazing. And we all knew that we were going to be coming in off of the end of the Peter Mary Jane marriage. Uh-huh. And but we didn't know how they were undoing the marriage.
Yeah.
And we all arrived for our first summit, and Joe Quesada, the editor-in-chief at the time, took us through what became One More Day. And quite frankly, we were all like sitting there looking at each other going, oh my God, that buzzsaw that we're literally running into looks really sharp. But then we got over that, and we just sort of embraced the, you know, it really was a brand new day for us. Like, it, you know, we were embracing all the stuff that could feel new, but also some things from, you know, past comics that we wanted to go back to, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of Peter being single and dating yeah. and the Parker luck and all that stuff. You know, we just really embraced it. And it was just a period of incredible, incredible, just creative fuel and creative, you know, excitement. As we also sort of, you know, navigated the idea of doing a 3 times a month book,
yeah.
you know, with like this, I don't think it really had been done before,
no.
Certainly not at Marvel. And we were sort of building the plane in the air.
Yeah.
You know, and it was an incredible amount of fun. All those guys are amazing. Bob Gale, Zeb Wells, yeah. Dan, obviously, Joe Kelly came on board, Mark Wade came on board. And it was just the best group of guys.
Has a murderer's row
yeah.
of comic yeah. book writers. That's insane. What a cool writer's room to work in.
It's a great writer's room. Oh my God. Yeah. Like you're just sort of sitting there going like, I'm not smart enough to roll with these people.
Well, and to essentially,
you learn a lot.
And like, not that you like reset Peter's continuity, but in a way, I mean, Harry was alive again, you know, like.
Yeah. Yeah.
I forgot Harry came back with that.
Yeah.
That's right.
This was when like Harry came alive. Yeah. Peter's back living with Aunt yep. May. Like it truly was
a brand new day.
Yeah.
I thought the best thing that came out of that story was him dating again, because as soon as Peter Parker, yeah. this kind of eternal, like you said, Parker luck, as soon as he married a supermodel, you lost a little something. It was different challenges for him, but I really enjoyed, because I knew they could always go back if they wanted.
By the way,
2 years
spoken,
later.
Spoken like someone who has no regard for their Twitter timeline.
Oh no, sir, I'm only on X. I don't follow Twitter.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Well, but one thing you learn in comics is like, don't worry about it. You know, like there's either yeah. like Captain America saying Hail Hydra, don't worry about it. There's a reason for it. Or then they'll fix it later. It's very rare in comics to ever see somebody who got completely yep. character assassinated by one decision a writer made.
That's exactly it. It's you know, this unbelievably long running narrative where, you know, everything happens and everything gets undone and then it happens again, but in a different way. And yeah, just chill out a little bit.
Hank Pym.
Just relax. Yeah, yeah. Well,
Hank Pym was changed forever.
He was. Yeah. I mean, those are rare. Yeah, those are very rare. I mean, there's very, very, very few things that, you know, like, it's funny, like Hank Pym, you know, Captain Marvel dying. But there was a time when, you know, for the longest time, Bucky, you know, coming back was inviolate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, everything is always just waiting for just a better yep. story or another story.
Just the next story. Yeah. I'll never forget. What was it when Doc Ock was Spider-Man?
Oh, so good.
2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And gosh, the outrage. But it's one of the best arcs of Spider-Man that is out there.
If you think about it, and I've gotten in trouble for saying this in the past, so clearly I'm going to say it again because I can't help myself. Like, so back, you know, back when we were doing Brand New Day, you know, gay marriage wasn't legal yet. And the rationale for why it shouldn't be legal is that, well, you know, gay couples have civil unions. And, you know, a civil union is just as good as a marriage. So what's the problem, right? And, you know, they're all the people who are like complaining, well, Peter and Mary Jane are no longer married. I'm like, well, basically, fundamentally, what we did, they still dated. They still lived together. They still everything. Mm-hmm. We downgraded their marriage from a marriage to a civil union. And if you don't see that that's a downgrade, then, you know.
I love that.
Thank you. But I've gotten so much trouble for it. So much trouble for it.
Oh, that's so good.
But that's fundamentally what we did, you know? Or I really should say what Joe and Joe did. We had nothing to do with it. We just inherited it. Please don't at me.
Well, before we get to hear me out, I do want to ask, you know, you've had the pleasure and of getting to play in so many different universes. Yeah. And television and film and comics, video games, you know, is there one IP, is there one character that you've not yet got to touch that, you know, for all the Hollywood producers or comic book editors that are watching this right now, listening to this, like who's the one?
Well, the only one I haven't got, well, there's touching and there's like doing like a run on.
Yeah.
But if we're just talking touching, Then I have to say Indiana Jones. Indy's the white whale, the one that
same.
You know, has sort of gotten away. But I do have an idea for a Indiana Jones adjacent television show that I think could be really cool. And I'll just pitch it now because it's never going to happen. Ravenwood.
This is your Hear Me Out.
Yeah. This is my Hear Me Out. Okay.
Here, you're going to start the Hear Me Out. Mark, go.
Ravenwood, The Adventures of Abner Ravenwood.
That's great.
And his young daughter, Marion.
I would watch that.
Right?
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yes.
Could be really cool. So that's my Hear
Me
Out.
That would be so cool. That would be so cool. It's additive, but it doesn't it's not going to affect anything that's pre-established.
Yes, exactly. It's nice and clean.
Depending on how young Marion is when she meets Indy.
Right. Well, and I love that it would be an even earlier period than we've got to explore in that universe thus far. I think, the more modern the Indy goes, the less it works.
And I totally agree. And I think, by the way, the pilot is him getting his hands on the Staff of Ra, the medallion of that Staff.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
That's the first episode.
So good. So Thank good. You. Well, I greenlight it.
Thank
so
you.
It's
Thank you. Well, Heather, I know there's a better than even chance that one day you'll be in the position to do that.
You and Ryan tell me that all the time.
Oh, I'm always saying, look, if studios need somebody to run your shit, I got a continuity expert right here.
It's more than that. It's the way she works with talent. It's the how far ahead she thinks and how strategically she thinks and creatively.
As long as we're complimenting you, Heather, one thing I always love about not just working with you here, but on Screen Crush is your just intrinsic understanding of story. And, a lot of us will see a story who aren't professional writers like you guys. We'll see a story and something about that didn't work, but you'll know it. And you'll be able to pinpoint that. Our Acolyte discussions and Book of Boba Fett discussions, you were the one who kept playing. Why does he want to do crime? Why have they not told us in the first episode why he want to do crime now? So, it's great working with you. And I'm stalling because I don't have a Hear Me Out, really.
That's okay. You don't have to have one this week because Mark had the best one. But I have one as well. And Mark, I want your expert opinion on this.
Okay, I'm ready.
As an ex-litigator, as a lawyer, my Hear Me Out is that the classic Disney animated film Little Mermaid is really about contract law.
Oh my God, that is so true. Yes, that's
right.
So true. Yes, Ariel makes a contract with Ursula. There is consideration for the contract.
There's fine print. Yes. She signs it without reading. Yep. I think
she's a minor. The contract should have been null and void.
I know.
You beat me.
She's
beat
a minor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
But undersea law works slightly differently.
I was going to say, is there a court of Ursula? I mean,
it's
but one could also argue that the contract was made in bad faith because Ursula uses Ariel's voice to manipulate the deal.
That is true. I think the suit has to be filed in small clams court.
But who
I was
going to
say,
is
it a civil suit?
Is that Triton or is it an octopus that plays the drums? What are the rules? We don't know how undersea law works. None of us are qualified to make this argument one way or the other.
It's a good point. But I feel like that should be the next Little Mermaid movie.
Is the court, or a series.
That is an animated series. No child would watch Law and Order.
Law and Order. Law and Order underwater.
And King
Law and Order Mediterranean or
yes.
whatever. Yeah.
Caribbean.
Pitch
Caribbean.
It. Mark.
We should totally do that.
Wait. Are they in the Mediterranean in Little Mermaid? Do they
I think it's the Caribbean.
I don't know. I think it's the Caribbean.
I think it's the Caribbean.
Yeah.
But wait, for Prince Eric's castle, did they sail all the way back across the Atlantic Ocean?
It's colonizers. Who knows? They built a castle.
Right. Yeah.
And on that note, I think that's a great place to end this, don't you, Heather?
I do. Before we say goodbye to everyone, Mark, can you please tell folks where they can find you as well as anything upcoming
yes.
for July, August, and the rest of the year that folks should keep an eye on?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, you can find me on Blue Sky at Mark Guggenheim. You can find my Instagram at Mark Guggenheim. I haven't been on Twitter since Election Day, and I'm actually going to delete my friggin' account. But I am also on Substack, where I publish a mostly weekly newsletter on Fridays called Legal Dispatch.
Highly recommend his newsletter. It is so good.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. And thanks for reading it.
I'm the one.
You are. In terms of, you know, in terms of stuff coming up, I'm writing two ongoings for Marvel right now. One is called Star Wars Jedi Knights, based on, you know, Jedi Knights. And the other is Spider-Man and Wolverine, which is a total crazy craziness that Kari Andrews is drawing. And I'm also, I also have a 30-page Justice League story, Justice League Dark Tomorrow, which I wrote with Mark Wade, the illustrious Mark Wade, and is drawn by Cian Tormey. That's coming out like right before Comic-Con. I want to say August, maybe later. At some point in the next couple of months, Marvel's publishing a omnibus of all my X-Men work.
That's awesome.
I'm really excited by it. Really excited. Like,
congratulations. Thank you. That's awesome.
I'm super
psyched. Incredibly cool.
I'm super psyched. So yeah, good stuff coming. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff I can't talk about.
Of course.
Yeah. We'll cut. Course, then we get to hear the good stuff, right?
Yeah.
I'm working on one thing. It's an animated show. I'm working on two animated shows right now that I would love to talk about, but there's one that I'm doing with my wife. It's the first thing that she and I are working on together. I'm like, oh, can't we just leak this? But eventually.
You can tell me.
You can come back on too. Like, yeah. This hopefully will not be the last time we get to speak.
Love that. Absolutely. It'll be fun.
Thank you so much. I cannot believe I got to speak to you. This has been so much fun.
No, thank you guys.
Thank you so much, Mark.
So this has been my co-host, Heather Antos.
And this has been my co-host, Ryan Airy.
And let us know what we should have asked Mark down in the comments below or at either of us on any of the social media sites we have linked below or on our free-to-join Discord server, which is like the internet before it became awful. Thanks so much, guys, and smash that bell and subscribe for alerts and all that stuff. Talk to you later.